rule. Okay, I'm going to start now talking about the background sort of issues, and then finally about Heidegger himself. You've got the syllabus. So look at the syllabus, because lots of what I want to say is on the syllabus there, on the handout. Did everybody get a handout? No. Uh-oh. We used them all up? That was the syllabus. Hand them around a bit. I printed 160. That's how many people are supposed to be here. What I didn't probably count on, I'll bring more next time, and I'll put it on the website. But unfortunately, the website thing is what's written on the handout. If you haven't got it, you might want to borrow it from whoever's next to you and copy down the URL and get it that way. It's too complicated to write on the board. Okay, now, so I need to see how many are. I'm not going to throw any auditors out because I'm convinced there's going to be room for everybody. But how many are auditing this course? Okay, for the time being, auditors, give away your syllabus to the people who are taking it and who have to know what the reading is going to be for next time. And I promise you more next time. So the reading for this week is on the syllabus, and it's not very many pages. I didn't count them. Let's see, 4, 7. Well, it's normal, about 17 pages. I'm going to try to assign about 20 pages a week, which sounds easy. Reading 20 pages of Heidegger is like reading, I don't know, 200 pages of anybody else. It's very hard, and it's very condensed, and as long as I've launched into that subject, I'll stick onto it for a while. I mean, one reason there's going to be more room is that some of you, I'm sure, shouldn't be taking this course, because I just have to tell you, it's the hardest course in the philosophy department. It isn't my idea to make it the hardest, far from it. I try to make it as clear and easy as I can. But Heidegger is so complicated and condensed and original and difficult and sometimes badly translated besides. And so, for one thing, he presupposes a certain chunk of the history of philosophy and the jargon that goes with it. So the first thing is that it's a requirement that you take 25B or some other course in the history of modern philosophy somewhere. If you haven't had Kant and Descartes, at least at the level that you have it in an introductory philosophy course, you shouldn't be in here, and you won't get you'll get a bad grade in here, and you'll feel lost. So I don't know how many people that discourages, and I don't feel like asking you to raise your hand if you're discouraged, but I have a feeling some of you definitely shouldn't be here. I just don't know which ones, and if you're uncertain, then you should come and see me in office hours. My office hours are tomorrow, Wednesday, 2 to 4. It says so on the syllabus, but I can't be sure that the people who need me have the syllabus. And 303 Moses. Yes, you've got to come and tell me why, if you haven't had a course in the history of modern, you still think you can take it. And one option to bear in mind is taking it pass, not pass. If you really, really are on the borderline of whether you've got it or not, and if you don't want to have a bad grade on your record, you can always take it pass, not pass, except for those in philosophy. Then there's the problem of whether it will count toward the major. You get to have one pass, not pass, toward the major in philosophy, and you may want to use it for this. And now, in preparation for this, besides requiring 25B, there are two courses that are just a big help. And unfortunately, Searle is on leave, on sabbatical this semester. Sometimes he gives his philosophy of mind course right before this course, and that is a mind-boggling confrontation, because he's close to Husserl and Descartes, who are the people that Heidegger is trying to demolish. And so, but in any case, how many have had Husserl philosophy of mind by any chance? Oh, terrific. Well, I'll mention him every once in a while. And you might want to write papers when you see how you've got to choose. You can't believe Husserl or Searle and Heidegger, and the confrontation is momentous. So, and how many have had Kant? Well, that's another good thing. Kant is being given this semester. And in a certain way, I want to say, well, it would be a good idea to consider taking it at the same time. However, Kant is tied for hardest course in the department, and two of them is really, if you do, you better be careful and not take anything else that requires a single neuron, because you won't have any left. So, but now I don't know, if you want to say anything in response to what I've just been saying, you should, because it's probably on the mind of some of you, some question that if I heard it and answered it would settle something for some of you. I don't know what, I mean, I do have to know. How many think that they should wait and take it the next time around, which is after what I've been saying, where you, if they take 25, okay, that's good, a brave person. To take, you know, I won't give it next year, so that's a problem, but I will give it what would be, the year after. And you may want to wait to take it till then, if you can. And because the more philosophy background you have before you take it, the better. Any questions about any of that so far? Yeah.
I'm sure most of us are taking this class because you're teaching it.
Well, that won't simplify. I just didn't teach it.
I'd like to know if, for the betterment of those who might not be prepared to be taking this class, if you're going to be teaching it again.
Well, that's what I was just saying, but I didn't say it in clearly enough, obviously. Yes, and everything else being equal, I expect to teach it again, not next year, but the year after. I try to teach it every other year because it's a very important course. And Heidegger's the entrance to, I think, practically everything that's interesting in contemporary philosophy comes from Heidegger. So, yeah. Mike Martin.
Yeah, I'm taking that. Is that even helpful, or do I need to?
I was wondering myself. I think it won't be very relevant because it's the furthest thing from Mike Martin is sort of cutting edge contemporary philosophy, and it's the furthest thing from them to be trying to sort of revive Descartes, which is what John Searle, I think, is doing. He wouldn't like that description of it, but taking Mike Martin is fine, but I don't think it'll help with Heidegger. Yeah, what would help with Heidegger? I didn't think it's being given though. Is it? Is Wittgenstein being given? No. How many have had Stroud Wittgenstein course or Sluga? Either Wittgenstein course. Well, that'll be helpful. Heidegger is close to Wittgenstein, or vice versa. Heidegger even. No, Wittgenstein, who said in some conversation which is written down that he can well understand what Heidegger means by being, and Heidegger's running up against the limits of language. That's a sensible thing to say, as you will see. And so, okay, so let me go on to, I'm going to continue to talk about the syllabus for a while. I wrote down a whole bunch of recommended texts on the syllabus. It didn't occur to me, though it should have, that somebody really ambitious and trying to do everything to do well in the course might buy all of them. And that cost a fortune, and I didn't think of it that way. So, and the next time I write a syllabus, I will do something about it. To begin with, it's really remarkable that more and more and more books are coming out about Heidegger faster than I can read them. And this is only a subset of the Heidegger books of the last 5 years. I think Heidegger and Wittgenstein, in a way, are sort of tied for the most important philosophers of the 20th century, only it looks, and this is just my feeling or prediction, that Wittgenstein's influence is waning and that there are fewer and fewer Wittgenstein books, and Heidegger's influence is growing at an alarming rate. I've never seen so many. Introductions to Being and Time, there must be about 10 out there now. But what I put on this list was all the ones that I thought were good ones. But I think One, that the best way to do this course is to read just Being in Time and read it over and over and over before I talk about it, and then after I talk about it, and then when you're writing your paper on it, and there's nothing as good as that. And, of course, listening to the lectures. But if you do want to read a book about being in time, one is probably enough, maybe two. But these have different merits, so let me go over them. And because I want to suggest that those of you who did buy all the books on this list might want to consider your option of being able to give them back, some of them. Okay, here we go. My favorite is Bill Blattner's Heidegger's Being in Time, which just came out a few months ago. The background is Blattner was an undergraduate here at Berkeley about 20 years ago, sitting in a course like this with me, maybe in this very room, and he understood being in time. He is so smart that he understood being in time better than I did, for sure. In a way, he thought better than Heidegger did. His paper in this course was not only explaining Heidegger's view of temporality, which is the hardest thing you can imagine, but explaining why it was wrong, which is mind-boggling. He was a junior. Then he went on to Pittsburgh to work with another student of mine, John Hoagland, and he wrote his PhD about Heidegger's temporality and Kant's temporality and why Heidegger was wrong. And then he published a book called Heidegger's Temporal Idealism. It's not on this list because it's hard, and we're not going to do temporality. Now, I better tell you this, not that it's going to change anybody's mind. I'm going to do Division 1 of Being in Time this semester. It's too hard to try to do the whole book. So just to give you that picture, I'm sort of interrupting for a second. If you see from the syllabus, don't read the introductions 1 and 2 until the end. That's how I set it up, because they're very hard, and they presuppose the book. Clearly, Heidegger wrote them after he'd written the whole thing. And we're not going to read Division 2. The Introduction 1 and 2, they're all right. They're at the beginning of the book. But halfway through the book, or two-thirds, it switches from Division 1 to Division 2. Division 2 is about death, anxiety, guilt, and temporality, and it's sort of a mixture of the sort of most existentialist side of Heidegger and this very complicated view of temporality that he's got. And I'm not going to do it in this course. However, I will do a seminar on Division 2 next semester. And if you like the course, and if you got an A or an A minus in the course, then you should, or you can consider taking the seminar and going on and doing Division 2. It's either a threat or a promise or an inducement or what. But so now let's go back to this list. And by the way, keep feeling free to interrupt me, because I'm sure the things that are on your mind, if you are trying to understand the implications of these considerations, are on other people's minds too. Just wave your hand. Meanwhile, I keep wondering, I'm just out of thinking, why are there so many more people here than there are seats? There's supposed to be 160 people in the course, and this room is supposed to seat 155 people. Who are all these people? What I'm going to do, if this continues, I don't want to get rid of the auditors, but I'm going to say that the auditors should be the ones sitting on the floor on the edges, and the people taking the course who need to write on the and so forth have the seats, and that's how I'll do it. Okay, back to the list. Blattner's book is my favorite. He finally wrote a relatively to the other stuff he's written, simple introduction to Being in Time. It's very clear, but it doesn't sacrifice the complexity, but it just explains it well. The book you probably want least is the next one, Taylor Carman's, because that is interesting only, I think, to people who are up on current analytic philosophy, because what Carman does well is constantly relate Heidegger's view on this or that to somebody's current view on this or that, mostly only of interest to graduate students in philosophy, I would think. So that's probably the one most likely to take back if you did buy all the books on this list. How many bought all the books on this list? How upset should I be? Good. I'm not upset anymore, but I'll go on and explain this anyway. So Then there's my commentary. It's sort of, I guess, helpful because it's similar to what I'm going to say, but it's only about, I don't know, 75% similar, because I, after 20 years, I've decided that there are lots of things wrong in the commentary. If you get beat on by smart philosophers and TAs and undergraduates and graduates, pretty soon everything you say looks like it could have been said differently or better or maybe not at all. And so I will be kind of correcting my commentary. How many have got the commentary? That's what I thought. Good. Well, I'm glad you do, because I don't want to waste people's time. However, I do want to correct the commentary, because I'm doing a second edition now in which I hope to get it righter this round. And so, okay, so much for that. Guignol's book is, students love it. He got his PhD here 25 years ago or so, and his way of sort of setting Heidegger in the kind of traditional epistemological issues that were the main issues at Berkeley at that time are still interesting. If there are people out there, let them in somehow. How, are there lots of people out there? Well, we want to get them in here. Just a second. Let me think. Well, come in. Can they walk over? Is there room for them to walk by you all? And they can come and sit up here? You can sit wherever you can find a seat, or you can sit on this big empty space up here. But you shouldn't have to stand outside the door. Okay. So Guignol is one that students like a lot, and it sort of just orients you into where Heidegger fits in the sort of history of modern philosophy. And then come three, well, let me skip the next three, because they're by Heidegger, and that's special. Then there's Pohl, my former TA, who taught this course very happily and successfully for many, many years, thinks Pohl is the best of them all, that every student should be reading Pohl. I don't much like Pohl, so you'll have to make up your own mind. I mean, I think Blattner and Guignol are better, but I can't go against my old TA, Rick Canedo, who was a very, very good understander of students and of Heidegger, so he's on the list, that is, Pohl is. And Rathall, I forgot to, Adam, did you have a chance to look at the Rathall? Rathall's a special case, interesting case. He got his PhD here about 10 years ago and wrote a thesis on truth in Heidegger. But what's interesting about this book is that it's a kind, he takes the way this book is supposed to be. It's a certain kind of book, How to Read Heidegger. You're supposed to take very, very hard passages, central hard passages, and explicate them. And he does that, and he does that very, very well, because he's very clear and smart. So Rathall is good to look at. Now, I've got all these books on reserve in Howison Library. That's the philosophy library, which is on the third floor of Moses, next to my office. I'm in 303. I don't think it has a number, but it's there. And all of them are there right now, except Blattner and Rathall, because they're so recent. They've all come out in the last few, both come out in the last few months. But thanks to Amazon, I think they will be there on Thursday. So then, you, instead of buying all these books, you can just go look at the ones and see which ones are really helpful to you. Any question about that? So the main thing is to start reading Heidegger. That is crucial. And, oh, I realize now something, that there's going to be fewer people. Unfortunately or fortunately, I don't really know. I'm going to podcast this course. That means that, at least in my past experience, I've podcast two other courses. Nobody else in the humanities except one other person podcasts their courses. This is a mystery to me. Now, are you and anybody else in a podcast humanities course this semester? What is wrong with my colleagues? I don't know. Anyway, I remember now thinking, well, the room may be a little too small, but last time I podcast anything, about 30% of the students disappeared. And if 30% of you all disappear, I will feel bad in a way, because I like to have as many people to have a conversation with as possible. On the other hand, I think it will solve the no room to sit down problem. It's thanks to this, it's being podcast right now, but not simultaneously, but in a day or two it will be around. Let's see, what else do I have to tell you? I had a whole list of important things to tell you, which I then didn't bring. Oh, yeah, here it is. Where are we now? Okay, about the books. One more thing about the books. It's very important. I'm surprised nobody asked which translation to buy of The Being and Time. The answer is you've got to have the Macquarie Robinson translation. You just can't make it in the course with the Stanbaugh translation, both because it's not as good and she muffs up a lot of very complicated things to make them simple, but she also makes them false or not true to what Heidegger's trying to say, but basically because the way I teach this is I'm constantly referring to Being in Time and reading things from it and explaining what they mean, and I want you to all have in front of you the same text and in sections too. So get the one that I checked in the bookstore. That's the one they've got, the one with a black cover and white printing on it. And that's the one you need. In paperback or hardcover, it doesn't matter at all, but it has to be that translation. Now, okay, about grades. Somebody is going to ask that sooner or later. There are two papers. Count the papers roughly 45% each. So as to leave 10% fudge factor for whether you come to discussion sections and contribute. You're supposed to. They're required. In this course, you need all the help you can get. And one of the things you can do is in discussion section, say things and discover whether you're on the right track or not and get put on the right track. So if you come to discussion sections and you're on a borderline between grades, you'll get put up to say from B plus to A minus, and if you don't, or if you come to sections and don't say anything, which is just as bad as not coming, then you get put down to from A minus to B plus. So think of it as very important that you come to discussion sections. And if you're listening to the podcast of the lectures, it's absolutely crucial because you've got to have some sort of real live touch with the people with the text and the people who understand it. We've got three TAs who really understand it, and you're gonna appreciate their help. Okay, I'm still. Any questions about that? I'm still going through my whole list of things. Graduate students could do a 15-page paper instead of 2 7- or 8-page papers if they want to, and if they clear it with me. It makes perfect sense for some people who've had enough background, but it makes absolutely no sense for undergraduates to try to write a 15-page paper unless you're Bill Blattner. So here we go. Let's see what else. No discussion. Oh, yeah, no discussion section this week. In philosophy, the way we do it is, how many are philosophy majors? Wow. I didn't know we had that many majors. Okay, so you guys know, or presumably. Anyway, the way we do it is we ignore the sections that you've been assigned to by the computer, and we put on the board the set, because I don't understand, nobody understands, at least not in our department, how the computer can assign sections when the computer doesn't know what commitments the TAs have to seminars and courses on their own. And so we're going to do it our way, which is the TAs will write on the board next time three times that they can meet and each of the three TAs. And you'll have a choice of nine times, and then we'll give you something to write your first, second, and third choice on. And then the TAs will sort them into such a way, hopefully, that everybody gets their first or second choice. And if there's a problem, we'll have to negotiate about it. But anyway, we're going to do that Thursday. And then the first discussion sections will be on starting next week. And next Monday is a holiday, which is a further complication. If you get assigned to it, are any of you going to teach on Monday? Probably, but I don't know. Maybe not. Anyway, if it turns out that we're teaching sections on Monday and you get assigned to one and there isn't one because it's a time, it's a holiday, if you can, go to somebody else's for the first week. Don't sort of fall behind just because it's a holiday. Now, I've covered, I think, everything, but I'm just to make sure.
Sir?
Yeah.
Because of the difficulty of the test, is it all right if we show up to other sections?
Besides the one you're in? It's an interesting question. I don't know. Sounds like a nice idea on principe, but maybe that if there's too many people, to let the people who are really in the section talk. I guess it's like this. You can show up to other sections if the person giving the section says it's okay. And they will make the judgment of whether you will improve the discussion and so forth, or just be a bother. Okay. Now, anything else? Okay, I'm still back on my list, but I think I've come to the end of it. There's going to be a website for the course. I'll put my announcements on there, and I'll put my charts on there. Oh, on the back of the syllabus, you've got something important, which I have been talking about. I haven't quite finished, because that's telling you which of the recommended, where in the recommended reading there is something that turns out to be relevant to what it is we're talking about that week. And that's pretty straightforward. What isn't straightforward is, and what I hadn't talked about, and nobody called me on it, but I said there are these three Heidegger books under the recommended text, and that's a special case. It's important to know that after, 30 years of teaching Being in Time, just with Being in Time to go on, maybe 20 years, I don't know when, but something like that, all of a sudden, with Heidegger's, when I guess it was they waited till he died? No, I don't think so. Anyway, Heidegger started publishing his posthumous papers, having written very few books, maybe 10 at the most. Heidegger is publishing about 200 volumes of all the lectures he gave, absolutely every one. He wrote it out, and it's being published. There are about 100 of them volumes. Anyway, there are three lectures around the time of Being in Time. And they say the things that Being in Time says, sometimes more clearly, sometimes with different examples, sometimes putting them in the context of the history of philosophy, and they can be very helpful. So Basic Problems is the most interesting. It was the course he gave on Being in Time, in a sense. It was the course he gave the year Being in Time was published. And it's interesting to look in there when it's relevant. It's in the library. The next one that's very helpful is The History of the Concept of Time, and that's 1925, I think, which is Being in Time is published in 29. Anyway, that's an early draft of Being in Time, and sometimes that's a lot clearer, and because it gets very condensed. Heidegger seems to, what takes up several pages of The History of the Concept of Time can show up as a paragraph in Being in Time. And I explain all that on the page about the reading, and I try to tell you where to look in the concept of time, the history of the concept of time, for the relevant passages, but I don't say anything about formal and transcendental logic. And just to forestall a question, that's because I'm only telling you what to read up through the first 6 weeks when the first paper will be due. Nothing in formal and transcendental logic becomes important and relevant until the second 6 weeks. So I'll tell you what's in there. That's after Being in Time. That's a very, very interesting book, about 2 years after Being in Time, in which he's sort of focusing it differently. Now I've covered everything on my notes. Last chance for general conversation. Anybody have any loose ends? It's amazing. Yeah, okay.
Are you going to give us a list of what suggested reading after?
I will. But when the time comes nearer, because I just haven't got that in my mind, on my mind right now. Yeah, I will, certainly. How would I abandon you all after 6? That would be crazy. Okay. Oh, well, the way we do it in philosophy now, and maybe in your earlier time too, is I'll give you a list of suggested paper topics, it's better for you, and probably will make a better paper, if you come up with your own topic with something that you find is puzzling that you can straighten out, or something where you think Heidegger contradicts himself, or whatever, or where you think you can explain the phenomena better than he's got the phenomena of focus. If you can do that, then you can write your own topic. Only, you always have to clear a topic with your TA if it's not on the list of suggested topics, because we don't want to let you just go off the deep end and compare Heidegger to something that it's incomparable with. Okay. Yeah.
You said that Heidegger is the entrance to everything that's interesting in contemporary philosophy. Can you just say a little more about why it's true?
Oh, I'd love to. In fact, that's right here on my list. It was going to come a little later, but not much. But so let me just put it in the place where it belongs, I think. So I've said already that Heidegger's either the most or tied for the most important philosopher in the 20th century. And in general, that's because he's so original and he calls into question so much of traditional philosophy. You could say the same of Wittgenstein. But Heidegger's certainly doing it very different than Wittgenstein, who's sort of starting from scratch. Heidegger is standing on the shoulders of two very important philosophers, Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, and very influenced by them because they were already calling into question, radically doubting that the whole philosophical project made any sense. And what Heidegger does is understand them very well and make them systematic. They each wrote Kierkegaard writes his books under various pseudonyms from various perspectives. Nietzsche writes in aphorisms. Heidegger, at least in the time of Being and Time, not later, but in the time of Being and Time, writes like a systematic philosopher. But he's systematically taking apart the whole philosophical tradition the way Kierkegaard and Nietzsche were starting to do it. And why is that important? Well, it's because what Heidegger's arguing, and Kierkegaard and Nietzsche were already, that there's something wrong with the whole tradition which is trying to have some kind of theoretical understanding of what it is to be a human being. And if you understand what human beings are, and if you understand what theory is, which I won't try to explain right now, you will see that that's not right, that that's treating human beings as some special complicated kind of object. And human beings aren't some special complicated kind of object. They're something entirely different. But Heidegger doesn't want to go to the other extreme and say, well, then a theoretical understanding of nature must be wrong too. After all, science is just one more human practice. A popular view around here a few years ago, I hope it's losing its popularity. Anyway, Heidegger thinks, and I like his view on this, that you can have a theoretical understanding of nature, and that's what modern science is, and it's getting it right about nature. But it makes no sense to think that you can do the human sciences that way. That means that in history, psychology, political theory, sociology, anthropology, all of those have to be dealt with differently, which means that when you hear cognitive science, which is supposed to be the science of the way the mind works, or cognitive psychology, or cognitive anthropology, well, from Heidegger's point of view, they're all wrong. And that's an important, if that's true, given all the interest in cognitive everything, it's important to know it. I don't know what cognitive neuroscience, I think it's probably all wrong too from Heidegger's point of view, but I'm not sure what cognitive neuroscience is committed to. I mean, in the background you can just think, if it looks anything like a computer model of how we do whatever we do, think, act, socialize, perceive, and so forth, from Heidegger's point of view it's wrong. That's why I wrote my book, What Computers Can't Do, on the basis of reading Heidegger, and had this weird effect of sort of creating a new field by bringing these two things together that were so obviously belong together because Heidegger was opposing the whole idea of computer models before there were any computer models. So that's one reason why he's so important. And that's why he's so important in Anglo-American thinking. But that's not why he's so important in continental philosophy. That's really, to me, the most amazing thing. All of continental philosophy of the last half of the 20th century, at least, is Heideggerian, or is totally based on Heidegger. Couldn't exist without Heidegger. And for those of you who happen to know some of these people, that won't be our philosophy majors who are carefully protected from hearing about most of them, all of them are, and I'll just tell you, Sartre, of course, being in nothingness, is
as I heard a famous French professor say, and I think rightly, a brilliant misunderstanding of being in time. You have to be a kind of genius like Sartre to take a book like Being in Time, which is anti-Cartesian through and through, and rewrite it as if it was a Cartesian book. I mean, you learn a whole lot that way, but nothing much about Heidegger, I think. But Sartre is no doubt, I mean, Sartre would be the first to say this, he's just fixing up Heidegger, as any natural, intelligent French person would have to do. But then there was a different kind of French person who really broke out of Descartes, thanks to Heidegger, and that's Merleau-Ponty. I teach Merleau-Ponty's Phenomenology of Perception sort of every other semester, every other year or so. Nothing to look at now. It's even, if anything, harder than Being in Time. But it's harder than Being in Time because it's so badly written. Whereas Being in Time is very clear. Merleau-Ponty is extremely murky. But he's deep. He takes over Heidegger. Two big gaps in Being in Time. So huge that it's sort of amazing that people didn't see them right off. Heidegger has nothing to say about perception in Being in Time, which is pretty amazing, and nothing to say about the body. And those are the two things that Merleau-Ponty thinks about, and the only two things he thinks about. But there's a full-time job and a tremendously important book that comes in the space that Heidegger opens up. And Merleau-Ponty talks a lot about Heidegger, hardly ever mentions him, but his vocabulary is all over the place. And he just takes Heidegger's ontology and Heidegger's vocabulary and applies it to what it is to be an embodied human being perceiving things. So, okay, there goes him. Probably not very many have heard of Pierre Bourdieu. How many know Pierre Bourdieu? Okay, well, more than I thought. Okay, you may know that Bourdieu made a kind of, reputation denouncing Heidegger. Because Bourdieu is such a strategist that on the French scene, that since Derrida had taken up Heidegger, to clobber Derrida, Bourdieu wrote the ontology. Anybody remember the a book anyway about Heidegger? But Bourdieu is a Heideggerian in two ways. One, he told me that his first love in philosophy was Heidegger, and two, he told me that he thinks he's applying Merleau-Ponty to the social field. And since Merleau-Ponty is applying Heidegger, Bourdieu is applying Heidegger at second hand, and he knows it. He was beating on Heidegger because that was how to get ahead in the French world at the time. Foucault actually said on his deathbed that the main influence on his life was Heidegger, and he says it in this famous bedside quote, where, by the way, it's complicated in French. In France, Bourdieu got ahead by sort of bashing Heidegger, Foucault got ahead by pretending that he'd never heard of Heidegger and only on his deathbed, when he didn't have to worry about how he looked on the French scene, could he say that he felt that he was a Heideggerian through and through, except as he says, Nietzsche won out in the end. So the structure of Foucault's thought is Heideggerian, but he does a Nietzschean variation on it. All of this you probably know. I mean, Heidegger was a Nazi for a while. For how long isn't too clear. But in 35, he published in 57, I think it is, he published some lectures from 1935, Introduction to Philosophy, to Metaphysics. What's the bad book? Introduction to Metaphysics, in which there is the sentence that describes the inner truth and greatness of National Socialism. That is something to be upset about, and why people in France, particularly right after the war, like Merleau-Ponty and Foucault and Bourdieu and so forth, weren't going to go around saying they were Heideggerians. But one person who really got upset about it, and he's the next one, is Habermas. How many know about Habermas, the most important philosopher in Germany? He just hates Heidegger, and what you don't usually know is until he saw this sentence, he was a total Heideggerian. He loved Being in Time. He was terribly disappointed to discover that Heidegger's been a Nazi. And this I like a lot, Habermas is such a great guy. He is so honest and so committed to philosophy. He actually published the following sentence in his book on the Discourse of Modernity, that Being and Time is the greatest philosophy books in Hegel's Phenomenology of Mind. When you hear that coming from somebody who really hates Heidegger because he was a Nazi, and you see how important Habermas thinks that is, that means that when the dust clears, we're going to hear about Plato and Aristotle and Kant and Hegel and Nietzsche and Heidegger. These are the big people. Okay, so we've got everybody on my list now. And Levinas, who's got his own criticism of Heidegger, but whose first book was on Heidegger. And Derrida, whom we've all heard of, I think. I found this sentence, which I copied out because I think it's sort of obvious that Derrida is a kind of Heideggerian, but he says in an interview called Position, what I have attempted to do would not have been possible without the opening of Martin Heidegger's questions. So there they are, all of them. I don't think I've left anybody out who's anybody on the scene in continental philosophy, and they're all Heideggerians. And now finally, yeah. Badger is a terrible philosopher. I don't even care if this is being podcast. He's a disgrace to philosophy and to France, as far as I can see. Is it? Well, I don't think he's clear enough to be a Heideggerian. We're talking about Badiou,
yeah.
And it's Lacanian. And Lacan is a sort of Heideggerian, too. I didn't go into it. Yes, there's a kind of maverick Heideggerian strain there, but I'd rather he hadn't been, or doesn't. Okay, I'm glad Adam knows about this. I've listened to lectures by Badiou. I find it practically unbearable. So let's see now. Okay, and finally, what about the American scene? We've talked about where Heidegger comes in continental philosophy. Well, he's coming up strong on the American scene. I can give you two reasons to think so. One is that good people in very good places, smart people, are publishing with very good publishers books on Heidegger, of which there are some here, but I didn't nearly list them all. And they're working on Rathall is going to bring out a new translation of Being and Time, which is going to be better than either of the ones that are around. And there are two important philosophers, anyway, in the Anglo-American scene who do take Heidegger very seriously. And that's Charles Taylor, on the one hand. I don't know if you ever heard of Charles Taylor. Have you, anybody? And Richard Rorty. I bet you've all heard. How many have heard of Richard Rorty? Everybody. Well, anyway, they take Heidegger seriously. But that's not enough. It's going to be important when a whole generation of very smart students takes Heidegger in America takes Heidegger very seriously. I think it's about to happen because one of our PhDs, Sean Kelly, now is a tenured professor at Harvard, and he's going to be teaching very, very smart students, of graduate students, about Heidegger and Merleau-Ponty, and that's going to make a difference. So I think in the end, there will be an influence of Heidegger on American philosophy. Okay, now, that's the answer to why I think Heidegger's important. Now we have to say what Heidegger says, and we'll do that. Let me see where we are. Okay, we're ready to talk about being, because this is called Being in Time, because it's all about being, and it's very hard to understand what Heidegger means by being, and Heidegger says it's very hard for us to understand even the question of the meaning of being. So I will do my best for the rest of the time, for another half hour, to try to orient you to why somebody would be asking the question about the meaning of being and what sort of answers somebody could give, and telling you first the wrong answers, and then from Heidegger's point of view, and then Heidegger. Okay, so there is a traditional understanding of being that goes back, way back, to Aristotle and Plato too for sure, Socrates. I think Heidegger thinks that the pre-Socratics didn't have that, and he thinks the pre-Socratics were on the right track, and then they got sort of detracked. I don't know what the right word is, waylaid by Plato. But the traditional understanding sort of comes to a big focus and clarity in Aristotle, and that is that being is a being is a substance. The way of being of entities, of the way of being of beings, is to be substances. That's a mouthful, but I'll tell you that means that, and you all believe that, and you've all heard that in all lots of philosophy courses and in endless variations. So there is this lectern. It's that's the ultimate kind of being. And what is it? Well, for Aristotle, it's a self-sufficient entity. That's what it is to be a substance. And it's got properties inhering in it. That's the other thing that substances do. So this is brown, and it's hard, and it's heavy, and it's probably got a lot of other properties in it too, inhering in it. And the properties depend on the substances. You can't have the properties running around without inhering in some substance. But the properties also have a kind of independence. That is, the being hard and being brown and being heavy, each of those properties is self-sufficient in its own way, meaning it doesn't need any other properties to be that way. I mean, to see why that's a funny thing, why anybody would doubt it, you've got to see that Merleau-Ponty thinks that the woolly redness of a carpet is different than the shiny redness of a fire engine and so forth, even though they all could match the same color strip red, because properties are not independent of each other, but are all holistically related in perception. That's what we're not going to talk about. But because what we're going to talk about and what Heidegger's going to talk about and reject is what you could call an atomistic account of substance and of properties. I don't mean it chemical atoms, but I mean that whatever the basic elements are, now not talking about science, but just whatever the basic, I don't know, I can't think of a good word for this, except being, pieces of being are, or something like that, are independent and of each other. The properties are not affected by what substance they inhere in. They're not affected by the other properties, and the substances aren't affected by each other. It's all atomistic in that sense. And the opposite of atomistic is holistic, where everything is influenced by and depends on and couldn't be what it is except for everything else that's involved with it. And we'll get to that in a minute. But right now, we just got to see that for Aristotle and for the whole tradition, to be is to be a substance. And in German, that's Vorhandenheit. And that gets translated different ways in different translations, of course, and unfortunately. Vorhandenheit. That means presence at hand. And that's how it gets translated in the big Heidegger book that you've got. Presence at hand is the way of being of substances. And I've just tried to describe the way of being of substances. It's this self-sufficient, atomic way of being. And that gets translated as presence at hand. At hand. And in the basic problems, for instance, it's translated as extant, which is not very good, I think, but that's how it came out. In my commentary, I'm not sure I still believe this, but in the commentary it's called occurrent. We're naming the way of being of substances. The way of being of substances is presence at hand, is Vorhandenheit. And you can translate that in lots of different ways. That makes it all the harder in this course. When you start reading, I got to say this, when you read other texts of Heidegger, or when you read commentaries on texts of Heidegger, they're all using different words for these crucial German words. So not only do you have to learn sort of a new language, namely Heideggerian, to read Heidegger, you got to learn a lot of different dialects of Heideggerian to read the different translations of Heidegger. That makes life difficult. But you've got to keep it in mind. You've got to keep in mind and look in the glossary. I mentioned that on this on the page I hand out about supplementary reading, because it's you won't understand anything if you think that having read a lot about presence of hand and being in time, you're now reading about the occurrent and basic problems, and you don't see that it's the same thing. And sometimes right inside of being in time, they're crucial words. I wrote it down here because I care so much about it. At the very bottom of the page of stuff about reading, there's this word Vorauf hin. If you don't understand, if you don't translate it right, as our translation calls it, towards which, it calls it the, what else does it call it? Anyway, it has to mean on the basis of which. And that's a very, very important notion in Heidegger, but we're not ready for it yet. But I want to draw a general conclusion, a warning. When you read Being in Time, there are certain words which, if you don't get them right, you can't possibly be understanding what you're reading. And if you come across the towards which, I wish I could remember, there's another wrong. On the well, that's the right meaning. On the basis of which, there's one more wrong one. On the basis of which is okay. In terms of which is maybe okay. But anyway, there are certain words, and I'll warn you, that you should correct, so to speak, and really, really write in the right one, because you can't understand it unless you get the right translation. And certainly, I want to say it now because I may forget to say it when papers are becoming due. When you're quoting Heidegger, when you're using some of these very wrong words, it's very hard to understand by you and by the person reading your paper. Put in one of the okay translations. These are all okay translations of Present at Hand. There are only certain words, which I don't want to go into right now, which are not okay, and which completely mess up the meaning. Okay, back to where we are. So presence at hand is everything that is self-sufficient is a substance, and everything that is a substance is self-sufficient. Tables are substances, trees, the sun, numbers, whatever. And that's what Aristotle was interested in describing. And this goes through the whole history of philosophy and finally comes out in our time as the fact that there are substances and they have properties gives you a subject and predicate understanding of the same phenomenon. You name the substance as a subject, the table, and you predicate of it being brown. That's the property. That leads finally to the predicate calculus, which is all about how, in general, the formal structure of substances with properties. And then you get the funny, interesting phenomena that it looks, if you believe this ontology, as if all you need is the right story about all the subjects or substances in the world and all their properties or predicates and how these are all related logically, by formal relations, you could describe everything. Now, who would have thought anybody would believe that? Well, that happens to be what people in artificial intelligence believed. They're the ultimate heirs to this present-at-hand ontology. John McCarthy at Stanford believes to this day, unless he's changed his mind since I last saw him, that everything intelligible about the world and about human beings can be represented in the predicate calculus. That's exactly what you get if in your ontology you think that the only kind of being, the only way of being, is present at hand. Then everything must be understandable as present at hand. And if you've got a formal model for understanding everything as substances with properties, you ought to be able to understand everything. Well, that didn't work. And Heidegger's got a very good account of why it didn't work. And now I think everybody thinks the good old, what John Hoagland, another Berkeley PhD, thinks called good old-fashioned AI, or what in more fancy talk is the model of the mind in which it has formal representations of the world, which it manipulates in logical ways. That whole way of thinking about human being, what happened is sort of you got substance ontology got turned into a research program by the people in AI, and it failed. So that's one good reason for reading Heidegger, to see what happened there. People wasted a lot of time, and DARPA, the Defense Department, wasted a lot of money trying to get trying to sort of apply substance ontology, and it didn't work. Well, why didn't it work? Well, you can sort of intuit why it didn't work, can't you? I mean, if the essence of it is the self-sufficient character of the substances and their properties, of the subjects and their predicates, then if things were holistic, it wouldn't work. And the genius of Heidegger is to take the most obvious and simple case of the holism of our world or our experience and work it out and show that it's not understandable in terms of substance and properties, and moreover, substance and properties are derivative in some way from this. Well, what is this? What is this other way of being? Well, it's the being of equipment. Heidegger takes it up talking about hammers. And he says that what's characteristic of all equipment, only he'll just do it with hammers, is that a hammer's way of being is such that it couldn't be a hammer if it weren't for there being nails and wood and houses and people who had the skills to make pound nails into wood. All of that has to hang together for something to be a hammer. When I get to this, how many people, I mean, maybe too far in the past now, anybody seen The Gods Must Be Crazy? Is that still around? I mean, there you get the case of something which for us is part of a whole equipmental totality, a Coke bottle in which you put liquids and it has a cap and there are Coke bottle openers and there are Coke bottle machines and there are glasses you pour it into and so forth and so forth. And it gets thrown out of an airplane and lands in this tribe in Africa and they don't know what to make of it. It's just a substance. And so they try to fit it into their world by using it to roll tortilla-like things or to hit each other over the head with as a weapon and so forth. But it's certainly not a Coke bottle. There is no way for it to be a Coke bottle in that world of those people. So the whole idea is, for Heidegger, that you can view a Coke bottle as a hard, greenish, sort of transparent substance. But then you'd miss what it is to be a Coke bottle. Same with hammers. You can regard a hammer as a wooden shank with a metal blob on the end, but that doesn't get it for what it is to be a hammer. And it now comes a trickier move. You might think, well, all you need is to add something. That's this wooden shank with this metal blob on the end, and it has a bunch of properties, long, hard handle and shiny, heavy, blobby end and so forth, and it also has the property of being for hammering. Aha! Now it looks like you've sort of absorbed it into the substance ontology. But, of course, that doesn't work because being for hammering suggests that, one, it leaves out when, sort of why you're hammering, and why, when hammering is something, if you just took the thing out and bashed a rock with it, you wouldn't be using a hammer. You wouldn't be hammering. Hammering is something that is sort of culturally defined as this piece of equipment is for driving in nails, for attaching wood, for building houses, and so forth. It's got this normative element. You can use a hammer as if it were a screwdriver to open a paint can, but it doesn't make it into a screwdriver. It's got to have a place in the practices of the culture in which it is related to a lot of other equipment and to the goals, to the skills of people, and to the goals of people. So in the end, Heidegger thinks that we'll talk about this more next time. He says the hammer has a in order to, that as I pick up the hammer, in order to hammer in nails, it has a towards which, that is a task towards putting these pieces of wood together. It has a final towards which would be, say, building a house. And then it has even more beyond that, a for the sake of which is somebody building a house is doing it for the sake of shelter or for the sake of being a home builder or being a carpenter. Finally, this equipmental thing ends up, no, I don't want to say any more about it for the second. It ends up that way. And now I just want to write that on the board somewhere. We're talking, so there's a second way of being. And this way of being is holistic and can't be dealt with in the substance. Oh, look what's back there. Nothing I can use. Okay. Well, you think I'll get the other one down? Oh, well, that's an interesting promise. Let's try it. Look at that. Okay. So here we've got Sue Hondenheit. Am I writing big enough to see back there? Okay. That's a way of being that in our translation is readiness to hand. And in my translation, I decided to call it availableness. I regret that. I regret it because it suggests that a hammer in a drawer still has the way of being of readiness to hand. I think for Heidegger, the hammer only has the way of being of readiness to hand when you're hammering with it. And so availableness is misleading. Zu Handenheit is Heidegger's word, and I think readiness to hand will do. I don't really have a candidate for the best translation of these, but I'm going to use the translations unless it's really wrong, like the way it deals with Vorhofen sometime. I'm just going to stick to present at hand and presence at hand. That's the way of being of substances, and now we've got a second thing, which is readiness to hand. And that's the way of being of equipment. This is a very, it's the sort of general property. No, I can't say that. It's very hard. It's what it is about equipment that makes it equipment is going to be described as readiness to hand. And then it's that whole complicated story of holism and interrelatedness with our practices, with our skills and so forth. All that goes into what it is to be a hammer. And the name for that whole system, that way of being, is readiness to hand. Okay, now let's see where we are. And that is why good old-fashioned AI and all these cognitivist enterprises are going to fail to begin with, is because they're all assuming that you can get along with a substance ontology and ignoring this vast amount of stuff, which are hammers and all sorts of equipment, which is so basic for what it is to have a world and be a human being, and they can't account for them because they can't capture the holism of it. In fact, the whole point of being a substance is not to be part of a holism, but to be an element in an atomic order. And if it's true that for equipment to be equipment at all, to be it needs to be fitted in this holistic structure, well then, there's a big problem, a huge problem. And there's a lot to be said for the next few weeks about all that. But I'm just going to go on because I want to give you the whole picture of what's going on here. So let me see. Oh, well, I mentioned, but we have come back to it, that Heidegger also sees something very interesting, that there is something which is not a property that hammers can have, and that's something which he calls, when he talks about it, he doesn't talk about it much, unreadiness to hand. A hammer could just, you know, turn into a present at hand object, and it wouldn't be a hammer anymore, it would just be a kind of thing. But a hammer can also be too heavy, and if a hammer is too heavy, that's a kind of holistic something or other. I can't call it a property, so I'll call it an aspect. A hammer is too heavy for me doing this job with these nails and this wood and this situation. You can't have just the property too heavy adhering in the hammer the way you can have it being heavy or being brown or being metal or something. And that's, again, an example. That's a kind of situated holism. Too heavy for this job. And that goes with equipment. But I want to go on. I got 10 more minutes and talk about the third way of being. There are three crucial ways of being, of which the tradition only knows one. I mean, it's hard to believe. I just, when I find myself saying this, I'm just always blown away that some things, these simple, obvious, pervasive, important things that Heidegger sees that are so clear and so incontrovertible, philosophy managed to go on for 2,000 years just not noticing it or not thinking it was worth thinking about. So now we've got this one, and now the other one is an interesting one, because the third way of being, what is the third way? What very important way of being isn't being an equipment and isn't being an object? Somebody's going to come up with this. Yeah. Being a human being, exactly, being us. We're not, our way of being isn't equipment. And you can treat people like equipment, you can use them. And you can treat people like objects, like doctors have to do. You can operate on them as a piece of meat. But you can't, but we, when we're being human beings, aren't equipment and we're not objects. Now, you might think, well, at least philosophers notice that. Surely they had lots to say about people. But Heidegger thinks, and I think it's fascinating, that when they talked about people, philosophers talked about people as a particular kinds of substances. So the soul is a kind of substance in Plato. It's a substance, and it's got three parts, and it's it's so independent of everything that it can be immortal and not involved in the world and not involved in time at all. So when philosophers noticed people, they just went on with their substance ontology. And you can just see it going on. And Descartes is interesting because he was upfront about it. What did he say we were? You must know. If you're not, you better leave right away. What's his name for us? The cogito is, that's what we do. Yes, we're a thinking substance. We're a res extensa. That's a kind of, that's what the world is. We're a res cogitans. We're a thinking substance. But the res in there is Latin for the substance word, ousia in Aristotle. But, you think, well, maybe they stopped thinking that way. But no. Leibniz has monads, and those are self-sufficient substances. And Kant has a transcendental subject, and that's a self-sufficient substance. I'm not so sure about Husserl, but I think Husserl thinks that we're a kind of self-sufficient something or other, which he calls transcendental subjectivity. And it's nice to have a wonderful, brilliant, homegrown version of this, namely John Searle. He's still got a substance ontology. He says we're minds, and we have mental states, and we have intentional content. Those of you who had the philosophy of mind course from Searle will know that. And he's clear that minds are self-sufficient, that the whole world might not exist. We'd still have this intentional content sort of directed toward the world. Husserl had the same view, even if there wasn't any world, because minds are self-sufficient substances. And they also have other internal states, like beliefs. You can have beliefs about all sorts of things, whether they exist or not, unicorns and so forth. You still, so the idea that we are substances is right there in front of us. How many of this, I wanted to ask this anyway, how many had the Husserl course this summer? Okay, well, I don't know what Joseph told you, and Husserl's a hard person to understand, but I'm pretty sure that Husserl thought, that John Searle and Husserl think very similarly, and that they are just the latest version of the substance ontology, that they think that we're a thinking thing, or an intention-having thing, or something like that. Intentional content is still a very, very fundamental hot term. That is, intentional content is what there is in the mind that points you towards objects in the world. So when I think about something, then I or believe something or desire something, the direction toward the something is the intentional content, and whether there is any such thing or not is another issue, because intentional content is self-sufficient. I mean, that's amazing, but it's still around. And you can always tell whether somebody's got that kind of view of the mind, because you can ask whether you can doubt the existence of the external world. Searle's quite upfront about it, that he thinks it's not interesting to doubt it, and nobody should go around trying to prove it. But you can doubt it, because the mind has got the content itself sufficient. It's like the Matrix. Only you get switched to the mind being identical with the brain, so that Searle thinks we could be brains in a vat, because it turns out that the substance of mind and the substance of brain are really so closely related. But then never mind problems like that. The important thing is to see that for Heidegger, we're not substances. We're not consciousnesses. That would be pushing us back to the thinking thing in Descartes. What are we then? What is our way of being? Well, our way of being is a kind of activity. We are what we do, Heidegger later says. That is, we give ourselves an identity by taking up a bunch of practices. So that's, remember when I stopped and said, I don't want to say that yet. Now we can say that we pick up this hammer in order to drive in a nail, in order to put these pieces of wood together, in order to make a house, and now for the sake of an understanding of myself as a carpenter. That is, all that activity amounts to taking a stand on my being. And now we get to what is the way of being of us, of now the word Dasein comes in there. What is that way of being? Well, that way of being is to take a stand on what it is to be that sort of being. And when I say take a stand on it, the translation says, and that's okay, it makes an issue of it. You don't want to make it sort of conscious. I'll talk more about that next time. You don't have to go around and say, I'm a carpenter. You have to take an extreme case. My favorite example is somebody could be a sacrificial mother, and that means that they've sort of got equipment for taking care of the kids and people who will make sure that everything gets done, and they're ready to give up whatever they have, whatever they desire to do it, and so forth. They've taken a stand on themselves, defined themselves as a sacrificial mother, but they don't need to know it. All they would say was, well, I'm just taking care of my children. I love my children. Well, everybody must feel the same way. The point is, this Dasein, which is us, by its using equipment and acting in the world, gives itself an interpretation of what it is to be a human being in general, and a human being in that particular culture, and this particular human being, like being a teacher in this case. And the name, we've got to have a name for that way of being. I doubt if you know that until you read Being and Time. The name for that way of being is existence. That one's easy to translate, existence. But Heidegger says, trees don't exist, and even hammers don't exist. There's only, and God doesn't exist. That isn't any big deal atheist claim. It's just a terminological claim that only human beings exist, because Heidegger's going to use that word to describe the way of being of human beings. The way of being of human beings is that, unlike hammers and trees, that for human beings, they are concerned in their activity to take a stand or have an interpretation of what it is to be a human being. That's a way of being, and he calls it existence. So now you've perhaps got a sort of understanding of what this question of being is. When you see that there are three kinds, and what you see that each of them is a way of making something intelligible. If you understand this way of being, that one, for Vorhandenheit, then you make substances intelligible. You're able to deal with objects. I didn't use the word objects because it's Descartes instead of Aristotle, but it's the same sort of notion. You're able to deal with objects and make sense of them. If you've got the understanding of being of zu Vorhandenheit, then you're able to deal with equipment and make sense of it. And if you've got the understanding of being, which is existence, you're able to deal with what it is to be a human being and make sense of it. So then you can understand a crucial sentence on page 25. Get that piece of my book. I'm going to stop with this because it's the punchline. He asks at the bottom of 25, what is it? What is asked about is being. Then he says, that which determines entities as entities. I don't want to talk about that. The crucial phrase is, that on the basis of which, the Vorhandenheit, which is right there, that on the basis of which entities are already understood. That means having this background skills on the basis of which you're able to cope with substances, equipment, and yourself. And to talk about the understanding of being is to talk about that which makes everything intelligible. Being roughly equals intelligibility. So the things can be intelligible as substances, they can be intelligible as equipment, and they can be intelligible as people. And what does all that have in common? Why are those all called modes of being? Vorhandenheit, zu Vorhandenheit, and Dasein. That's because those are modes of intelligibility. Now I'm sort of going out on my own limb, because when you read Heidegger, he's never going to tell you very explicitly. This is the most explicit sentence I know, what he's meaning by being. He's meaning that something or other, which we haven't explained fully yet, on the basis of which beings, all three kinds of beings, are understood, because you understand their way of being. Okay, that you look puzzled, and that's all right. I mean, it's puzzling, but I've done the best I can. See you next time.